The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of Spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
The first time I had seen porn, I was 7 years old. Later on in the story, I'm 10 years old, I was molested. Vulnerability is risky, no matter what way you cut it. Aaron, I think you're more addicted to passivity than you are to porn.
Dear young married couple, is pornography a part of your story? You may not realize, but porn is actually not the problem.
That's exactly what Aaron Zint found out when he was recovering from pornography over the past decade. So he is a pastor, author, and podcaster. He comes to us today with his story, but also some very practical tools for you to take and help you with changing your story. His book is called Numb to Known, The Surprising Path Away from Porn. And we're so thankful that he's joining us today.
It's going to be an awesome interview. And if you or someone else is dealing with pornography, this is the time to really get educated and to start working on this problem or working on the solution for this problem.
Exactly. Also, before we get to the interview, we wanted to let you know about our marriage retreat coming up in June on the West Coast. And it's going to be so much fun. You've probably heard us talking about it, but it's called Adventure and Intimacy Retreat. We'll put the link in the show notes where you can go register and find out more about it. And we hope you'll come join us, you and your spouse, for a weekend getaway full of becoming more known, and that results in being able to feel more loved. So we look forward to meeting you there.
Yes, come be with us.
All right, on to the interview. Welcome, Aaron Zint, to the podcast. We're so glad you're with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Felt super honored to be invited to your podcast because I've listened to a number of episodes with some really quality people on here. And aww. I was like, how did they get? I mean, you guys are quality all on your own, but I thought, how did you get Dr. Gary Chapman on one of your episodes? I was like, that's blowing my mind.
So. Well, you're cool. Quality too. So thanks. You're right up there with them.
Yeah, we love you guys, you and your wife.
Yep.
And their podcast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Marriage Lab.
Marriage Lab.
Right. Yeah. They're awesome. I actually worked with Jenna way back in the day.
This is Aaron's wife, by the way.
Yeah.
Yep.
At
a middle school.
Middle school.
Yeah. So crazy.
So yep, awesome.
Small world.
But she is an awesome person. Learned to love her and then met you when we were living in Reading. And
right.
Yeah.
Super just people that are awesome people. And you have come out with a book called Numb to Known, The Surprising Path Away from Porn. And we're like, okay, we have to have Aaron on.
Yes, we're looking forward to hearing your story, but not just your story. I think people who are listening are going to be able to get really key components from your story that they can apply to their own journey in porn recovery.
Right.
So I'm really looking forward to jumping into it with you.
Yeah. Well, I can start with just saying the first time I had seen porn, I was 7 years old, which is for the average about, you know, the statistics on this are always changing because depending on who they're interviewing or how readily accessible the internet was at the time of the study or what it changes. But it seems like the average age of first exposure is decreasing, as in people are getting younger when they see it.
That's right.
For me at 7 years old, that's very early. But even prior to that, I think what kind of set me up in a sense to have deeper hooks in me than it could have on somebody else is I had my first sexual experiences around the age of 4 with an older kid. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of, you know, at the time it was more confusing and just like, you know, it's just exploration as kids, but because this kid was older than me and as now that I know about what sexual abuse is like and all that experience, I've understood that this kid who introduced me to a lot of this stuff probably experienced their own sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. It would make sense for all the things that they introduced me to. So I was, because of that exposure at that early age, sexuality became like, I had a hyper-sexualized childhood that was all in secret too. Mm-hmm. And so anytime that did surface, like I got in trouble for acting out with another kid or something like that sexually. Mm-hmm. If I did, it was, you know, there's a lot of shame around that. Like, hey, sure, you should know better. Like, this is wrong. And so I think I internalized, you know, and I don't fault my parents for this because they didn't know how to, how to respond. And that was probably pretty scary for them.
But can you also describe the home you grew up in just so that people who are listening can understand like the context of the parental strategies?
Right. Yeah. So we were a conservative Christian family, pretty stable in most regards. And my parents were, you know, super kind, loved the Lord. And yeah, so that was the context for my childhood. And so I wasn't in a crazy environment. I wasn't in an environment that was conducive to experiencing this kind of stuff. But, you know, two kids playing in a room together, you don't think about that. And then when I was seven and I had found porn, it was a person that had been living with my grandparents at the time. And I was told to take a nap in his room. And so he wasn't there. And so because my grandma kind of ran a daycare, if you will, for me and my siblings, a bunch of other kids. So this exposure was never, you know, meant to happen. I wasn't introduced by somebody. It was just kind of this naivety on the part of my grandparents as to what might be in there. And then, so I see that at seven. But then I start exploring and finding in like homeless camps at the city park or different places like that. I find it more often, and then begin to actively look for it when I can. And this started a whole series, a whole childhood experiences of sexuality with other kids, sexuality with, you know, eventually the internet. I think I was probably like 13 when we got our first computer with the internet. Okay. And then it was definitely off to the races with that. And then even beyond like internet porn, it was, it began more like because of the hypersexuality, I was attaching most emotions to my sexuality, and especially joy. Like I get excited and be like, oh, let's figure out a way to include sexuality in this. And as a kid, it's just kind of around how my brain was formed.
Can you explain, Aaron, the hypersexuality piece?
Yeah, that's what I was just going to do. Just to slow that down because people are like, okay, what does that mean? You know,
is
that,
right?
Like, tell us like your experience of like how you viewed sex maybe when you were a little kid. That would make that hypersexuality.
Well, I'd say that it was hypersexualized in that I had a strong pull towards like seeing girls naked, a strong pull towards being like kind of exhibitionism, being naked in places that I, you know, quote unquote shouldn't, voyeuristic activities. And so there was this such a strong pull at such a young age. Mm. Like I think anybody who's an adult or a teenager who's been addicted to porn, or their just hormones are going crazy from puberty or different things like that might experience some form of hypersexuality where it's just on the mind very often. And so I'd say I call it a hypersexualized childhood because a counselor had once used that term and it resonated in me like, oh, wow, no, that's so true.
There's a word for this.
It made sense because there was so much extra focus than what is normal for that developmental age. Like there's normal developmental exploration. You know, even like masturbation for young kids is like, oh, my body part feels good when it rubs up against this. That's, you know, it's not sin. It's just like an experience. They're going, oh, that feels good. What you can do with that later on in life can become like sin-filled decisions, but at that age, it's not. And so, but it also doesn't drive the majority of your decisions. It doesn't, you know, it might feel good while you're laying in bed at night, but it's not going to be this, how can I figure out how to experience this, you know, 10, 20 times a day. So that's
And you feel like at a young age, you did have that extra it went beyond just, oh, this feels good. It was like, oh, how can this drive more of my day?
Yeah, it was a focus. And yes, yeah. And you know, if from the outside looking in, because I don't have that perspective, I don't know how, what it would have looked like from anybody else. I just, because of the memories that I have under, say, 10 years old, the number of memories I have around sexual activity, that's where I would go like that. I have kids now. I have a 9-year-old, mm-hmm. a 6-year-old, and a 3-year-old. And there's, you know, some level of their own kind of exploration of their sexuality in terms of just like, oh, that body part yep. feels good to touch.
Yep.
That, you know, we parent along the way, but I don't see in them the same experiences that I had at all mm-hmm. as a kid. And so
yep.
that's why I would call it hypersexualized.
That makes a lot of sense. And you think that potentially came from the 4-year-old experience and mm-hmm. then the 7-year-old exposure to pornography.
I think it came from, yeah, those things built upon each other. Like, I don't uh-huh. think that initial exposure as a 4-year-old, you know, it didn't like ruin me for life, but it did make me curious in a way that it did happen later again with that same kid. And so the kind of repeat, and honestly, like as I've been working through my own sexual history and working through some of the little T trauma events that happened, sexual abuse and things like that, I've different kind of memories started to surface that I mm-hmm. didn't remember. And so I was like, oh, wow, this actually happened more often than I thought. Mm-hmm. And so it was that kind of repeated exposure that kind of put it in my mind, oh, this is a thing. Mm-hmm. This is, that's what it was. And I think for a normal developmental, it's like, oh, this is just a part of my everyday experience of like the various sensations of life. Whereas for me, it became like the primary sensation yeah. to seek and to experience things like that.
That makes sense. Mm. Yeah.
That's so good. So mm-hmm. You said something that was interesting to me, and I would like to hear what your take is on this, but you said as you've like worked through your sexual history,
right.
This has been a process for you. This didn't mm-hmm. just come out
very much.
One day.
Very How, much, yeah.
What does that look like for you over time?
Yeah. So something that, because I help lead us like a men's sexual wholeness group. And one of the things we talk about a lot is exploring your sexual history and understanding it, kind of mm-hmm. building what we'd call a coherent narrative of your life. So that you can understand why you behave the way you do now, because there's a lot of components from childhood. And so one of the things that we do talk about, though, is we're not necessarily going on a beach with a metal detector and going, where is there, you know, where are there sharp objects that I can, you know, dig up? But as we are walking along the beach, when a sharp object surfaces, we are willing to actually stop, uncover it, realize sometimes there's a number of shards. And if we can yeah. start to like, clean that up is oversimplified word for what healing happens. Mm-hmm. But if we can clean that up, then my family's not going to step on those same objects that are there in my life. I'm yes. not going to continue to step on those objects again. And so my willingness to go, hey, this actually had an effect on me, because I didn't think it did. Like yeah. I used to think back on that and have no emotion about it. I was later on in the story, I'm 10 years old, I was molested. And so I also, from that experience, I would go into different inner healing sessions or counseling sessions, and I'd think about it and be like, I don't think it affected me that much because I feel nothing right now, mm-hmm. which is not an, you know, your present experience of it, of something emotionally doesn't necessarily tell you the kind of effect it had on you.
Yeah.
But actually stepping into some of those memories, realizing there's a lot of shame attached to those memories because of the yeah. complicity that was a part of my the molestation or the experiences with other kids or what have you. Like there was so much that I internalized as, oh, this is a part of the bad person that I am. Right. And so even realizing I actually should probably tell somebody about what happened, like, you know, a safe friend, a pastor, whomever, counselor, I should probably like actually share some of the details that I experienced because I really, really don't want to. And why don't I want to? Because it happened to me. It's not like I did something wrong in those given moments.
But you held that narrative probably for many years.
Yeah, and I wouldn't have been able to articulate that back then. But as I realized the amount of shame that was attached to a lot of these memories and the difficulty with which I would share something like that, I go, oh, yeah, my shame tells me that this is something wrong with me, which is why it's difficult to share and why it's easier to hide and kind of suppress everything.
So good. For those who are listening, that is such a key indicator. Mm-hmm. Like, that should tell you what Aaron just shared. Like, the degree to which you feel repulsion from sharing is also an indicator of how much shame you're probably holding to a safe individual. We're not talking about like telling everybody, but
we're not blasting this on Facebook.
By the way, everybody, this is to a trusted mentor individual, but that's a big thing to be aware of. How much shame are you holding around this?
Right.
And why do you think that you felt numb when you first looked back? Like, was it shame trying to distance yourself, like trying to not feel? So, and then how did that not feeling affect you in your marriage later on?
Yeah, well, there's a popular quote that is attributed to Carl Jung, but I don't know that it necessarily was him, but it says, until we make the unconscious conscious, it will direct our lives and we'll call it fate. And so within the Christian context, until we make the unconscious conscious, it will direct our lives and we'll call it discernment. We'll call it God. We'll call it my spiritual state. And so for the way that, yes, I believe that the reason most of it kind of went into this numb place was because as soon as shame indicates something, you know, the shame's number one job, besides telling you you suck, is to then hide you from the world so that nobody else can find out that you suck. And so the amount of isolation that happens because of shame, it's really sneaky as well in that it's so subtle. Like, all these memories I didn't think were needed to share because I didn't realize there was shame attached to it. I just never did. And until it came time to go, I think that might be a good idea. And I felt the like resistance there. I go, okay, I think my body and my brain were like, hey, we know how to keep you safe. And it's by not letting people into your inner world, because if they are, you're going to be rejected. Yeah. And so that's why I think that happens. But this affected me. The fact that I didn't really have the stuff sorted out or figured out or understood affected my marriage, because I showed up to my marriage with what this guy Andrew Bauman would call a pornographic style of relating. And he said, like, you know, we have attachment styles of relating with people: avoidant, insecure, secure. And the way that he said, like, when you grow up on porn, when you are like taught what sexuality is from porn, it kind of informs the way that you relate to people. And so part of that would be, I thought sex was for me. I thought the point of it was was to have a great orgasm. Like, that was the number one goal in marriage, was to have a great orgasm. And as a Christian, a sin-free great orgasm. You know, like, I had plenty of the sin-filled ones. And so, totally. And so besides the selfishness around that, the objectivity with which I viewed women and even my wife, not viewing them as entire whole people. There's a whole list of other things that he would describe as our pornographic style of relating to the world that showed up in my marriage, in the way the expectations I had of my wife, not just in sexuality, but in meeting my needs without me sharing my needs. Because Dr. Patrick Carnes, who's kind of like the godfather of sex addiction, he says the one of the four core beliefs of a sex addict is, if I have to rely on somebody else to get my needs met, they won't get met. And so part of sexuality, growing up with this kind of sexuality, is I have to rely on myself in order to be taken care of. Because if I try to rely on somebody, they're going to disappoint me. And that hurts way more than just not giving them a chance. And so with Jenna, that showed up a lot and really like leads into the the first or this part two of the book, which is I didn't realize I was lonely. And so that's
you have three of those in your book. Like, I didn't realize I was this, this, or this. And so that first one is I didn't realize I was lonely.
Yeah. Yeah. So the first section of part one of the book is just understanding that, hey, we don't have a behavior management problem as much as we have like a lot of things going on under the surface that need addressing. Porn is the is one of our solutions to the problems of isolation, passivity, and pain. And so part two of the book is talking about my journey in loneliness and isolation. And so how it showed up in my marriage is I didn't know how to share pain with my wife. I didn't know how much pain I was stepping into marriage with around sexuality, around unmet needs, around loneliness. And so within that context, I shut down my heart to my wife in the first 3 years of our marriage because there were so many instances of pain that, you know, my, you guys know my wife, she's amazing. She is, if I had any kind of like, if I had a lot more of this healing up front, I would have had a, such a greater experience because she's so good at caring and having compassion and
she is
listening. And so, but my, the filters through which I saw life, part of my attachment styles and different things like that, I, any kind of, anytime that I would be vulnerable in some small measure, I would interpret her reaction or the way that she'd respond as rejection. And I, it was just more confirmation, you know, this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, like, oh, see, it's not safe to share. It's best to just like shove it down. And I'm an Enneagram 9. So being unaware of what my own experience is part of that, you know, type. And so I shoved a lot of emotions. I shoved a lot of pain. And I even shoved excitement and joy down because, you know, they're joy and pain dug from the same well. You can't just like shut one off and hope the others show up. And so I found out, I realized it was like we were 3 years into marriage. And I realized at one point, I haven't cried in front of my wife in 3 years. I don't, that seems wrong. Like, cause I could cry in front of her before marriage. I had a number of like, I felt like an emotional person in general, but the key difference that this was part of the beginning, really the beginning process of my healing was realizing that, okay, even when I want to cry in front of her so that we can connect on something I'm feeling, I feel my emotions physically retreat within my body. Like I will have just cried with a friend or a family member. And then Jenna came into the situation and I'm like, oh, this is my chance to like connect. Cause I deeply, deeply wanted connection. Just didn't know how to do it. And then she'd show up and I'd feel all my emotions. Like just, I, you know, our emotions are so much bodily experience that I would feel like this literal bodily experience of everything kind of retreat from my neck. It would just kind of go down my torso until I couldn't feel it anymore.
Wow.
And I couldn't even force it to come up.
You were physically like, numbing your experience.
Yeah. Wow. And based on, and you know, I've come to realize like, oh, my brain was working really hard to protect me in those moments. Yep. And like, I'm thankful for its attempts. I'm just realizing how unhelpful that was for what I really wanted.
That's and powerful, so, Aaron.
There was a point I joined this men's group where they said, hey, sit in your pain, feel your pain, do this, you know, like, don't run from it. I'm like, I don't have any pain. My life's been good. You know, like my marriage is good. Cause even with my not being able to cry in front of my wife, there's a lot of good stuff in our marriage.
Sure.
So it was one night I was sitting with these guys in our small group and I felt really safe with these guys and everyone started sharing in a more deep and vulnerable way. And they said, hey, what's going on with you, Aaron? And first, I don't know how this came up or why it came up, but definitely like felt like the Lord was on it. What came out was I'm afraid to be close to my wife. And the moment I said those words, like a wave of tears came and it felt like the dam kind of burst in a way that I hadn't ever before. And I just like wept for probably like 10 minutes. And as I wept, all these memories of pain in our first 3 years of marriage, that from the outside looking in might seem benign. But as the Dr. Glenn and Phyllis Hill of the Connection Codes, they would say, hey, if you can hand somebody a 1 pound weight of emotion over and over and over, they can take it. But when you hand them 500 pounds, like that's going to crush somebody, you know? And what I realized is like, I had built up 500 pounds, so to speak, of emotion that had never been processed. And all these small experiences of pain that just built up so much weight and so much pressure over time came spilling out. And I was then, because I realized this, I definitely processed this quite a bit with these guys in the next few weeks before I dropped a 500 pound weight on my wife. But I did, eventually, struggle to hand her the weight. I told her, hey, I realized some stuff in group, and she knew the reason I was going was because of my porn use. And, that's a part of it. Porn was also has continued to play a part all through childhood up to my adult life. So, I told her, hey, I realized some stuff. It's going to be a lot, but I feel like I really need to share it with you. And she's like, I'd love to hear. So one night we're laying in bed and I was like, would now be a good time? She's like, yeah. So I was already trying to prep her and, I should have shared this stuff with you along the way. I didn't, that was my fault, but I feel like I just need to get it out. And this stuff isn't your fault, but this is just what I experienced. And so she's like, yeah, go ahead and share. So I start to share, because one of the main pain points was around our wedding night and all these unmet expectations I had, because of my pornographic style of relating. And the next day after our wedding, there was a lot of pain that she had just no idea that was happening in me, because I was so good at suppressing it. Yeah. I started to share with her, okay, so on our wedding night, this, and I could feel the emotions begin retreating again. And I was like, oh, dang it. And then I was like, okay, you know what? I realized part of my emotional retreat was I was using a lot of like logic, cognition, rational, like words, good insight. You didn't mean to. And here's, this is probably what you were thinking at the time. Just a lot of thinking for what was
analyzing the situation instead of being in the situation.
In some ways, that was distancing yourself. Like your language was helping you distance yourself from what was actually going in on air, like what was happening in you. And we'll get right back to the interview. But what we want to do is make you aware that we have a resource around this whole subject of talking with your kids about sexuality. And it's called Having the Talks.
And in Having the Talks, we address things like homosexuality, transgenderism, but even just the basics of sexuality, like anatomy and identity. We start the whole deck off with identity. And it's a resource for parents and children to play together. You could play it like a game. And it helps children as young as age 3 all the way up to teenhood. There's really two decks in one, because we have questions for younger children, and on the other side of the card, it's a question, same question, but for older children.
Yes, and this deck is designed to really bring these subjects up organically, so that you can really have this discussion with them and open a safe place for you to be an askable parent. So you could go to havingthetalks.com and get your deck. And it will actually reroute you to Amazon, and you can get it tomorrow.
Next day shipping.
Yeah, if you ordered it today.
All right, link in the show notes. Back to the interview.
Yeah. Right. What I realized, find out later, is the different parts of our brain, the left side, more linguistic and linear, rational, thinking, logical, and the right side, emotional side. Like I had relied so heavily on shutting down the right emotional side and would rely a lot on the left side to express what was happening. But that means I wouldn't experience what I was feeling. And so I realized it was happening, and I told her, I'm going to stop trying to qualify everything that I'm saying. I'm going to stop using all these kinds of words. I'm just going to tell you exactly what I feel. Okay. She's like, yeah, please. And the next words that came out of my mouth was, the day after our wedding was the worst effing day of my life. And I used the F word at the time. And with that kind of visceral language of, this is what I as I said it, I could feel it. And I was there the day after our wedding. And that's when the dam broke in front of her. And then I put my head on her chest and I cried, and she cried with me for probably like 10, 15 minutes. And I got to share, like, this experience happened and this, and it hurts so bad to feel this. And the waves that just kept rolling out of sadness and loneliness that I didn't know was pent up over time. And her just like being what we'd call an attuned listener in that moment to, she didn't try to fix me. She didn't try to interpret it. She didn't try to, nothing. She just cried with me. And it was after that experience, that was the first time in my life I felt known by somebody, truly known, because I was not only able to share with language my experience, but I was able to share, I was able to be in the moment of extreme pain and let her experience that with me and just be with me in it. And it was a lot of the stuff I didn't want to share. And so she was able to be with me in it. And it honestly, it changed a lot about our relationship that we didn't even know needed some help. But that's also what kicked off kind of the journey to uncovering the isolation and passivity and pain that was driving my porn use.
Wow.
That's incredible. And that's, you said that was the first time you felt truly known, that numbness went away and you were you were feeling known. That's the title of your book.
Right.
Did you continue this pattern of relating where you were raw and vulnerable and were able to feel known again and again and again?
Was it a struggle having to check
yourself? It was a struggle. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So like it was definitely, it was an eye opener to what was possible. I still was faced with the very real fear that if I was vulnerable, I wouldn't be met with acceptance. And this is, again, this is like on a visceral level, like you need disconfirming evidence for some of the things that you believe that are unhelpful. And I got disconfirming evidence that night that if I share myself, my what's really going on inside of me, I'll be rejected. Like she told me through her actions, like, no, you're not going to be rejected. However, I had years and years of self-confirming prophecies about doing that. And so I had a lot to unlearn. And it actually required a ton of courage each time that I had something emotional, because I was like, what if this is the time though? You know, and a lot of those emotional experiences that I shared with her in that very cathartic moment was moments where I'd shared something and I felt shut down. And whether she did a good job or not was honestly irrelevant, because of how I, what I perceived and then how I then behaved was more suppression, more isolation. So it was a process. It definitely, it was one of those things that, and this is where the passivity part comes in, is I would realize that I was feeling something. So this part of, you know, stepping out of isolation is building an emotional vocabulary, building an emotional awareness, taking regular inventory so that I actually, one, know that what I'm feeling, but two, can share that, because you can't share something that you don't have words for. And so as I began to build that emotional vocabulary and build that awareness, I realized more opportunities to share that with her. And the more opportunities, there was, you know, probably one out of five, I would actually share it with her, because I still felt that very real fear. But those times that I did share were really good. And then I would get more and more confidence to do that. And not just with my wife, but with other people. And so the more often I did that, the more it became kind of, eventually, you know, that was probably about, 10 years ago now. Eventually over the course of the next 10 years became second nature, so that when I feel some sort of pain, or even realize, oh, I stepped on a shard of glass, which we'd call triggers. You know, this, I got triggered. I'm like, oh, this probably has more to do with the way that I perceive the world and my past experience than my wife right now. The more familiar I got with that, it was second nature to go, oh, who am I going to tell about this? How am I going to get this outside of myself? Nice. Because I know what isolation feels like. It feels awful. And I also, now I know what feeling known feels like, and it feels incredible, but it still requires courage, because vulnerability is risky no matter what way you cut it. It involves risk, because you're going to hand somebody something that they could reject you with, but that's what makes it so life-giving when they don't. And so I just got more and more practiced at it. Still not perfect. There's still moments where I realize that I suppress, but
That's so good. It's like you figured out that keeping that story or that thing inside of you turns to shame eventually if you don't get it outside of you.
And even though vulnerability is risky, you recognized that most of the time it was worth it.
So what happened to your porn problem, Aaron? Did it just, when did it go away? air quotes.
Yeah. That's a very apropos thing to do for go away when it comes to porn problem. But I began to see, like, even after that experience with my wife of feeling known, it didn't change right away. Like, I still felt very drawn to it. And I'm like, at the time I thought there was always one root issue. Like, that was my experience of counseling, was like, oh, you discover one root issue, you solve that, and then you're good to go.
Done.
And I was like, crap. I thought that was it. So
I really messed up because I found two.
I know. Then you find out that it's like a whole root system, and you're like, yes. Oh my gosh, there's a lot here. So
that's a good way to put it.
Honestly, it was really as I began to deal with passivity that I found the most traction at that time. Like, it was little bits of better for sure. There was always an increase, like the amount of porn use decrease, and the time in between would be more spread out.
Okay.
As I began to build this emotional vocabulary, share it, get known, not build up all that pressure. But I was talking to my counselor at one point, this maybe like year five, it was like a year and a half after that experience with my wife that I began to see more traction. As I was talking with my counselor, and I'm describing all these ways that that I'm not showing up in my marriage or at work, or at least what I think I'm describing is everyone else's problems. He's really seeing the through line, like, oh, that's weird. Everywhere you go, Aaron, there you are. And you have these problems in every one of those situations. And so one of the things he said is, Aaron, I think you're more addicted to passivity than you are to porn. And in that moment, I was like, oh, what is, like, it feels true, but I don't know what that means. And in reality, I realized that in my work life, in my marriage, in my friendships, I had a lot of avoidance, avoidance of responsibility, avoidance of discomfort. Part of the nineness of the Enneagram for me was this extreme fear of conflict, because any kind of conflict means there's going to be relational disruption. And in reality, how that began to form my life is, I don't know that I can be okay with somebody who's not okay with me. I don't even need to be in relationship with them, but if they're not okay with me, I'm not okay. And so I learned this, you know, growing up, and kind of through the lens of my personality and stuff is how I began to interpret life. And so my counselor gave me homework. My counselor began to give me homework of, he said, okay, I want you to go. I was in HR at the time. It's a very tricky job to be in when you don't want to disappoint people. So he goes, hey, I want you to go to your HR manager and tell her, I want to be a part of every difficult conversation that you have, every written warning, every firing. And I was like, oh my God.
And that's where he fired his therapist right there.
Yeah. And I realized he was a terrible therapist. And then I moved on to somebody else and I didn't change.
Homework.
That is really good homework.
It's brutal. It's freaking brutal. But I wanted change bad enough. I knew, you know, that, like, if you want something different than you've always had, you need to do something different than you've always done. So I went to my HR manager, said that, and I began sitting in on these meetings that were the most crazy, uncomfortable situations like you can possibly imagine. Well, actually, most people probably would think they were fairly benign, but they were horrific to me. It was like watching a car accident happen in slow motion.
Oh, man.
And you knew it was going to happen.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And I knew what was coming down the pike. And so I had, like, I couldn't breathe in most of these meetings. Like, I would short gasps of air. I realized this because after the meeting was over, I'd be like, oh my gosh. Okay. And so the more I did that, it was kind of like exposure therapy in a way. But a lot of this, the courage it took in intentionality to step into an area that I thought I felt powerless in. I felt powerless to other people.
Yeah.
I felt powerless to other people's opinion. And doing this over and over gradually, like, taught my nervous system to go, hey, you're not actually in danger here.
Yep.
And the more that happened, like, on a bodily level, the more my brain was like, oh, I'm not short of breath anymore. Like, I think I'm more okay with this, until it came a day where I actually had to fire somebody myself. And I was by myself. Usually we have a witness there with us, but it just worked out this way. And I was not looking forward to it, but I also wasn't terrified. And I was like, wow, this is pretty big. So I go through the paperwork. He argues a bit and I just kind of stick to my guns because I also learned the tactics of doing this well. Mm-hmm. He leaves visibly upset and something dawned on me in that moment. I was like, he doesn't have any power over me. Like, I'm okay. I am actually okay right now. And there's a person out in the world who, when he sees me, he will associate me with bad news. And I just was like, I'm okay. This is incredible. And honestly, what that did on like such a deep level for me was start to reveal the amount of power that I actually had that I'd been giving away to so many people. And so passivity for me showed up a lot in a lot of avoidance of conflict. Passivity for other people, especially when it comes to, say, eights on the Enneagram who are way more okay with conflict and may even enjoy it. I got a buddy who that's him, and the way passivity shows up for him is he's terrified to look weak. And so he has a really difficult time taking responsibility for things that are his and saying sorry. And for me, that's totally easy. I can say sorry all day.
Sure. However, so passivity shows up differently for each person is what you're saying.
Very good.
Yeah. So that really began a change of, because really the core issue around passivity is I have given up my power so often to external forces, other people, that honestly, porn is such a powerful feeling because you control the environment. There's no possibility of rejection that's going to happen. I feel so powerful. And one night I had acted out and I went to my small group and acted out. I mean, like looked at porn and went to my small group and I'm like confessing and talking about it. And the guy was like, and one of the guys in my group, he's newer, he's like, you have a wife though. Like, why didn't you just, go to her for sex if you wanted it, if you were like horny or whatever. And so I realized in that moment, I was like, oh, actually I felt really powerless today. And when I have sex with my wife, it doesn't fill me with the feelings of power. Like that's a place where I go to lay it down, and to like be with her and to not be this dominant, feeling like I'm in charge here. Originally porn was always that for me. And so then I was like, oh wow. I wanted porn because it was this feeling of power that I craved in that moment. And the result of a lot of passivity from in that given day, things I avoided that I'm like constantly felt powerless to. And so that was where, as I began to move after the things that scared me, do uncomfortable things, get really comfortable with discomfort. Like that was part of it, is I just gotta, discomfort is a fact of life. And the more I avoid it, the more powerless I feel. So the more I can, when I recognize, oh, this is uncomfortable, and this is probably a good thing for me to lean into right now, the more powerful I felt. It took a lot of, like, I had to muster a lot of courage a lot of times, but
it's counterintuitive with someone who has that pornographic way of relating, even in recovery.
Right. Yeah. And so it began a long journey of leaning into that and realizing over and over, like, oh, wait, no, I am powerful. I do have what it takes. And so the moments where I would feel powerless and I'd feel that familiar desire to use porn as the solution for my powerlessness feeling, I can go like, okay, well, what are some other options here? Mm-hmm. And begin to like utilize all the various options that are out there besides porn. Yeah. So I would say now, like, when did it end? Well, it doesn't feel like it ended. Feels like some way that I describe what I would call freedom, or a lot of people would call freedom from porn, is it's how I think of David saying, you prepared a table for me in the presence of my enemies. And the way that I think about that as it relates to porn is, porn is still a possibility. Like, I have my phone right here. I have access to internet. Like, I could at any moment reach for that and use that as a solution for whatever I'm feeling. However, I have so many other options now. I have so many other options that I know are life-giving. And that's really what it is. I'm like, oh, my enemy is right in front of me, but I'm like feasting, so I don't have time for it. Yeah. Like, moment that I stop taking care of myself, I start suppressing or isolating or stepping into more passivity, being more passive around stuff, or just holding pain in me instead of sharing with somebody. The more I do that, the bigger the enemy grows in front of me and the less tasteful the food seems in front of me. And so then I start engaging with that enemy a lot more. And this one time I showed up at my house after a vacation, there's tons of flies in the house. I was like, what happened? I cleaned everything, found the food source, killed all the flies. You know, somebody could ask like, hey, does that mean you're never going to have flies in your house again? I'm like, no, as long as I take the trash out, I think I'll be good. But the moment I leave trash and for 2 weeks at a time on vacation, flies are going to show back up. That doesn't mean I'm going to be acting out every time. It just means the temptation, the desire to go after this, to use this as the best solution in the moment is so much more enticing mm-hmm. when I haven't taken good care of myself, when I am so isolated, good. When I am living passively, or when I'm holding pain and not sharing it.
Yeah, because mm-hmm. just porn is just a substitute. It's right. it's like having a ton of junk food that gives you really bad indigestion.
Yeah.
But if you have a feast, I love that analogy.
Yes. Right?
If you have a feast right there and you're eating your fill and you feel good and it makes you healthy mm-hmm. and strong, I don't really need to go to this other table that gives me indigestion every single time.
With the enemy totally. Right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes junk food just so much less desirable. You're like, yeah, I could eat that bag of chips. I know how I feel. And honestly, I've put so many other like parameters and boundaries within my life that I can see the potato chips, but they're, you know, it's in the other room and it's actually behind a case. I'm like, ah, so much work to get something that is not going to work that well. So
that's good.
I love that. Man, so good. Guys, get this book.
Yes.
Get this book because if you could be struggling with pornography, but there's most, even if you're not, you can be a mentor and a help to someone who mm-hmm. is.
Yes. And statistics would say that 3/4 of the people listening are struggling with pornography to some extent. Mm-hmm. And so this is a book you need to get, Numb to Known by Aaron Zint, The Surprising Path Away from Porn. And we will link it in the show notes so you can go grab that on Amazon, get it in a day or two. And Aaron, can you go ahead and explain this idea that porn is not the problem? Summarize that for us in a few sentences.
Yeah. Porn is the solution to the problem, is a solution, a damaging, unhelpful solution, but a solution nonetheless. And for a lot of people, the only solution they have to the problems of isolation, passivity, and pain. And addressing those root problems in your life will decrease your desire, need, and decrease the desirability of porn as an option, especially as you begin to discover all the various life-giving options that are available to you.
So good.
So good.
All right, folks, you heard it. Go grab the book. And we will ask you, Aaron, where can people find you on social mm-hmm. media or your other resources?
Oh, I'm so bad at social media, but my wife and I have a Zint Marriage Lab is our Instagram handle. My wife, Jenna Zint, is also just a blast to follow. So regardless of whether you care about this or not, follow her.
True story.
She is a blast.
Yeah, but we have a website, zintsquad.com. That's where you can, you know, there's a link to the book there. We offer emotional health, sexual wholeness coaching, couples coaching, things like that. And my wife does a lot of habit coaching for nice. People, which is phenomenal as well. So zintsquad.com.
Nice. Zintsquad.com and Zint Marriage Lab. And of course, Jenna. And we will put all of that in the resources. So folks, you can find the links to those in the show notes or the description if you're on YouTube. We're going to close out this episode the way we close out all of our episodes. And that's by asking you this question. Rewind back to your first couple years of marriage. Mm-hmm. What advice do you wish you would have received? And fill in the blank. Dear young married couple.
Dear young married couple, when you experience pain with each other, individually, whatever, get known as quickly and as often as possible by sharing the things that are in your heart without blaming your spouse, but share your experience, get known by them, and build a deep, life-giving connection through that vulnerability.
There you go.
Love it.
So good. Aaron, thank you so much for your passion on the subject, for helping men, for, you know, a lot of creative energy goes into this, and a lot of pain you had to go through to write this book and help people. So,
well, and talking about vulnerability, I mean, sharing your story with the whole world through a book—that's a lot of vulnerability that you've experienced just in the last month since this.
Yeah,
did it launch about a month ago?
Yeah, about a month ago.
Yeah. So new levels.
New levels. Yeah. Well, thanks for having me on. It was a huge honor.
Thanks, Aaron.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah. All right, friends. We really hope that you got a ton out of today's conversation. And if you want help, if you want personal guidance with individual counseling or couples counseling, or even help with you as a couple reaching the goals you have, just reach out. Give us a call at 916-678-1797 or shoot us an email at hello@dearyoungmarriedcouple.com.
No matter where you are in the world or in your marriage, we can set up a counseling session with you and we can work toward progress. We also post marriage advice regularly on our Instagram, which is @dearyoungmarriedcouple. And we'd love for you to join us in conversation there. All right, see you next week.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.